Major Wilfred, accession number 16718, Major Wilfred White, Reel 11.
Mr. White, Reel 11. So for some 2,000 yards, you were clear of the enemy. You hadn't quite reached them. Was there any fire coming towards you at this point?
Yes, there was. There was sporadic fire, shell fire. There's shell fire and mortar fire, machine gun fire, but it was. It could get heavier and did as you approached your artillery. Remember, the artillery at this stage were dropping on the enemy, and obviously keeping them a bit quiet. But we were just keeping formation, getting.
What were you personally doing in these initial stages as you moved forward?
Well, just keeping. As far as I could see, my platoon together, and going forward, watching the marking lights, you know, the Beaufort's firing, to make sure that our axes, and keeping contact on the left in this case, and listening to the trumpet going, knowing Teddy was up in front.
Were you in a line with fixed bayonets?
Mm-hmm.
So it was a platoon line?
Yes, well, it would be a whole company line. You know, might well have been the whole brigade line. Because when you've got your bayonet fixed, until the last minute, you have your sort of, in this sort of...
Cross your body.
Cross your body, yes. And so you come against a slit trench. Now, what do? If you see anybody out, you know, if you don't see anybody, a bit bored, you might fire around into it and, you know, keep yourself on your toes. But there was no sign of the enemy at this stage as far as I was concerned. I mean, you know, we didn't.
Were you able to make yourselves heard?
With difficulty.
Were there any form of hand signals which people could look for?
Remember, it was at night, so hand signals are very limited. This is the problem of control at night. So you've got to keep, you know, everybody's got to keep checking that the man on the right is still there. And you can start walking across the front of them if you want to, but you've got to be careful there.
But did you have any kind of person immediately behind, like the platoon sergeant who would keep them up as well?
Yes, well, that was, you relied on that a lot. He was there as first reserve if anything happened to you, really, but also he had the important job of helping you keep control. He could obviously see what you couldn't see, and You had him moving along the line quite a bit, ready to tackle anything that came his way. And they were, in the very limited experience that I had compared to many, they were inspirational people at a time like this. You know, they just were pieces of gold. They were magnificent men. All the NCOs, well, in fact, the whole lot were, but the NCOs and the sergeants and the sergeant majors really showed their worth. Great.
Were you encouraging them by shouting all the time?
Oh, not at this early stage. The shouting really started when you got scent of there being somebody. You can easily imagine you can't go shouting and screaming for a 5,000 yards advance, which ours was.
Is there a change in attitude, that scent that you talked about, when the enemy appears or you begin to get contact? Is there a problem then of slowing people down or staring them up? You know, the hunting scent.
There's no doubt about it, there is a change when you, for want of a better word, in amongst them. Now, I'd be telling a lie if I painted a picture of Force A and Force B standing up to meet them and Force A and B hanging over hand to hand. That happens rarely. In my, well, in my experience, God almighty, I've got none. But usually by the time you get to where they were, they've disappeared. At Marath, they didn't disappear. That was a different story. But on this one, I don't think, other than prisoners, I saw any of the enemy. Now, that's a big statement to make. I hope it's right. But there was, I wasn't in a, my immediate lot didn't sort of go meet it, a party of them who surrendered or what, before I left the scene. But we were just getting to the interesting scene, you see.
What was the visibility like?
It wasn't very far. I could see, you know, in detail, 10, 15, 20 yards ahead, because remember the sand was in the air as well as the night, and the smoke from the various exploding things. But, and as it got later and lighter, then the visibility was sort of near normal. I remember that just after I'd been wounded, but I don't know how long it was after I'd been wounded, saw the battalion commander go past me in the battalion carrier through one of the gaps in the minefields, and we sort of waved to each other. But that was just, that was, you know, sort of getting on for dawn when that happened.
What are your memories then, as, again, you're going through this distance towards the enemy, this X hundreds of yards, and you're getting closer. What was happening next?
Well, again, the sort of thing that was going on in my mind was, we'll be meeting them any minute now. Are your men up with you? You know, that sort of thing. And what's happening on the right flank, and what about on the left flank? And I was trying to make that sort of appreciation all the time. And have I lost anybody? Are we still all together? And I think, sort of between us, the sergeant and myself, you thought we had a fair idea that at this stage we hadn't lost any at all. You know, it could have been one or two, but there was no sort of, there was nothing more definite than that.
Was the hunting horn a stimulation for you?
Oh, most certainly it was to me. You know, I just liked that idea. I'd read stories in the First World War where the young, handsome officer is first over the top and punts a rugby ball ahead of the charging, you know. I used to think, well, that's a bit, you know, over the top. I wouldn't, if you'll forgive the pun, I can't see me doing that. Landing on it was quite in place, you know. A good thing to keep you together, You know, that's our hunting horn. And when I came home, I remember my father had kept the front page of the Daily Mirror or something with big letters about, you know, the hunting horn leading the charge at Alamein. That was our hunting horn, you know. It was this great sense of identity and typical of the man. Typical of the man. He'd show the buggers.
What happened to you next?
What happened to me? Well, we were getting along very well, everything apparently under control. I was pressing on a bit because I just had the fear, the feeling that with one thing and another, we'd got a little behind the barrage. And that I knew would be fatal. And there's suddenly a string of exploding something, shells in across my front. And, you know, four or five in line. And I sort of went, was sailing through the air backwards. I actually thought I saw this thing coming to hit me, which might have been imagination, you know. And I tried to jump. I thought I was jumping to avoid it. But it might well have been the way the memory works, you know, after I'd been blown up in the air and landed on my back. And was one or two of the men went with me, about five I think it was, and well, I'd been hit, you know, it was, so you...
What's the immediate reaction to a blow like this, in a situation like that? Do you feel something immediately?
Well, I didn't feel a hurt yet. I felt a hurt to my pride and a numbness in my leg. And I tried to stand up, which I didn't do, couldn't do. I couldn't control it. It was this leg. I couldn't control
the
left leg. I couldn't control it. I couldn't sort of use the muscles to... as you would when you're trying to get up. And I think the sergeant or an NCO had seen what had happened, that not only was I knocked down, but there's another five or six men knocked down. And he shouted for the orderly, and a wonderful young orderly, a young medical orderly, that is, came along and, you know, after few minutes confab. I had a chat with my sergeant, and I think basically asked if if he had any query about anything. And of course, the man was more attuned to this sort of thing than I was, really. But and then off he went, you know, with the platoon. See you sometime. Good luck. And that was that. And then the orderly stretcher bearer was what we called him, not the orderly. The stretcher bearer was going his round of the... And he was the lad that told me that there was five or six and that I'd been hit under the knee. It was bleeding a bit, but... he didn't think they had to take me leg off, you know, things, that sort of cheery thing.
Did he dress you?
Yes, he put on a first... We carried a first field dressing, they called it, which was bandages and a pad. So we got that on, and I still couldn't stand up. I still couldn't get up, sorry, I beg your pardon. Then I got them together. We stood me up, as it were, because by this time the sappers were going past on our right, you know, opening up the minefield lane, and there was all sorts of vehicles going through, and I just didn't want to be lying flat on the ground, so quite so near to the the M1, as it were, of this of the supporting tanks. I wanted to be seen, and indeed, that's when we I saw our battalion commander go past, and he shouted, "There's a machine gun over there, Scotty. Get after it!" You know. Fortunately, he passed before I could say anything back, because you know what a thing to do. It's difficult saying there's a machine gun on the top of that hill. Knock it out. But the flat expanse with a brigade of jocks on your left to go across. Oh, no, he was just as excited as I was. But thank goodness I couldn't move, really. And we got the, by heaving and hauling, we got the wounded, the other wounded, who fortunately, there was nothing serious. We got them all round to my little hollow, my little hill, or whatever. And I could keep an eye on them, you see, and or we could keep an eye on each other, really. And before the orderly went off, the meat wagon was up, the ambulance, incredibly, you know.
And is there were any of the men panicking with the wounds?
No, no. No, there wasn't. There wasn't even a cry, as I remember now. You know, let's be fair.
You say that it was a blow to your pride. What were your feelings or reactions immediately? Was there anger or fear?
I was very cross. I thought, well, this would be marvellous. 3 years of doing this, doing nothing. Training at Octu, things that flash across your mind. And the first time the fire is shot, you get hit. It was that sort of feeling.
Was there any fear about the seriousness of your leg wound? Did that hit you straight away?
Not at that stage. Not at that stage.
So the ambulance has arrived, as you say, pretty quickly.
Yes, certainly the wagon for the to clear the men away. Being the British Army, you see, we're going to different destinations.
The men were taken off one
in one line to the regimental edge post, and of course, I went off to another line to the regimental. I don't know whether it was the same regimental aid post as we called it, the collecting place for the wounded up at the front of the battle. I should think the same doctors tackled both people, but because of the way things are organised, there were different problems with men to officers. I'm thinking of things of documentation, probably, and because they really teed up to handle this situation in the most efficient way. We're within minutes. People in London know that you've just been wounded. And,
so the battalion MO would be with you now, and gathered around him, presumably with the stretcher bearers and the.
He would be organising the allocation of stretcher bearers.
A regimental aid post was not a tent or a building; it was just a place. Was it on the?
No, the regimental aid post, as I call it, was a tent, and it was where the. The medical facilities were such that there were doctors and surgeons there to give meaningful attention to the wounded. By meaningful, I mean to help the recovery part of it, not just putting a bandage on. You know, your wound was examined and cleansed and decently bandaged. Until and I don't doubt there's some notes written down about your wound on the record, but that was done by the proper medical facility. They were right up there, and in the case of the battle I'm talking about, You see, remember, we've got Cairo about 20 miles behind us, you know, with all its hospitals and base depots and things, so that, you know, you're unlikely to die of neglect. But a big South African nurse, female, came and picked me up. She's a lovely girl, but, you know, but built like a tank.
And she was as close to the battle as front that. As that?
Yes.
Are you able to estimate how far behind the attacking line was the RAP?
Well, at that stage, I would think, just guessing, we went back to the tents. I would say that we'd got about 1,000 yards. I reckon we were about 3,000 yards where I was wounded. We'd done 3,000 of a total attack of 5,000. And they were up there. Virtually, they came up and pitched that tents at our start-up line, as far as I can sort of estimate in distance. And you see, it wasn't just the DLI that were there. We had Maoris. In fact, I had a Colonel Baker who was leading the attack on our right flank, if you remember, as I said. And he'd had a bullet through his mouth in some way. The poor soul was in a dreadful state because his jaws had been broken, his teeth blown out, and his salivary glands were, you know, messed up. And he lay there, you know, lying on the sand on stretchers. He was stripped to the waist. He'd been magnificent strip, just like these Australian rugby players, you know, great muscles. And I thought, what a waste. And then we were there, as I say, they took my arms away from me, which was just my pistol at that stage. I don't think I had a rifle. And all the ammunition and all the grenades. So you totally collected in case of need. It had to be redistributed quickly.
Was there a reaction to the wound now setting in?
Well, I was beginning to feel it. Not for a bit. I wasn't too conscious of it at this stage. Because they don't tell you anything, you know. The worse than they are in hospital now, you know, you chop your leg off and they'll not tell you. Or you'll be all right, lad, was the sort of thing. And I was back into another meat wagon. I might even have been on the train, I can't be sure. Down into Cairo. And on the... In Cairo, there's an island in the Nile. I think it's the home of the Gezira Sporting Club and the 15th Scottish Hospital. The unit had raised its hospital tents and that, and had all the doctors and the nurses that were needed. And, you know, before 10 o'clock in the morning, I was in a bed in the corridor of this hospital, you know, white sheets. Still pretty mucky, mind. Me, I mean. And then it's all a bit of a haze then because of... It became uncomfortable when they took the dressing off. And of course, It didn't look too bad when I cleaned the blood and that off. it had gouged a big lump across there. You can just see the mark when you look closely. And
just below the kneecap.
Just below the kneecap. And the cartilages and the gubbins of the knee had been jolted up a bit, you know, weren't functioning quite the way they ought. But there's no question of you'll never walk again, or, you know, that side never came into it. It was a case of getting it healed up as quickly as possible.
Was this an officer's hospital? Or
yes. Oh, the 15th Scottish. Now, what a good question. Yes, I think it was just there was an officer unit to it, but it dealt with the others as well.
How did they treat you in hospital?
Oh, marvellously well. I mean, you've got to remember that even as a young boy to the army, to the battle, I hadn't been in bed for 5 or 6 months, and I hadn't seen a woman for God, Christ only knows when. And a pillow, what do you do with a pillow? And running water, it was wonderment. It was like leg or no leg, it was like waking up in, because it was, the pain was bearable, you know. You felt you were cheating, you know. You felt you were running, ought to show somebody how bad your leg was, you know, because you're getting, the food was good. I can't remember how good it was, but it was very good compared to what we were having. And only I had this bloody awful dressing daily, which became a bit of a trial, because as fast as it was growing a little bit, when they ripped the plaster off, they took it away, you know. It was, and then, after a month or so, we had to move out of where we were, not sure why, and we went to a hospital at a place called Geneva, which was in the desert by the side of the canal. Again, it was a 15th Scottish hospital, though. And they tried a new technique. And what they did was they bound it up with a plaster, you know, from here down to the ankle, and left it alone. But they gave me every 3 hours 2 white tablets, sulfonamide. It was just the beginning of the use of, I think, MB, I think they called it. And in other words, they're giving me this to counter the poisons in my leg, but they just let it rot away, you see. And oh, God, the pills were terrible. I mean, they've, as soon as you took them, because of the impurities or the nature of the drug, you felt ill, really ill, headache, dizzy, sick. And just as that wore off, they came along, gave you another 2. And a pleasant treatment, but it worked. And
was this still pre-penicillin days?
Oh, yes, a long way. But MB was the wonder drug, which I believe Churchill had taken ill out in North Africa round about this time, or just after this time, but he was somehow connected with the drug. He got it because he had, did he have a pneumonia or something while he was out there? And it worked wonders with me, but my God, I'd rather have the pain of, you know, the dressing. Fortunately, I did. It was all right.
Was there a discipline in the hospital that you had to adhere to?
Oh, yes, yes. Two little examples, or one little example, was the Gurkhas were on guard of the hospital, ceremoniously, you know, and whatever night the tank boys go crazy, I could walk with the aid of a stick at this stage, or a crutch actually, take the weight of it, and I could push my pal that I'd made in hospital, who was a tank commander, who'd had his head split open. And we decided that since it was not St. Valentine's night, but they celebrated big, the night, the first big tank battle in the First World War. And you know, he wanted to go out and have a drink. He said, "I know I'm not supposed to drink because his head wound." And well, we'd had one or two drinks, and when we went back, we realized we were an hour later than, you know, the hospital was closed for the night, obviously. And could we get past this guard? We tried to pull rank on him, didn't matter. And he had to send for the guard, and we were led in like naughty children. And got a verbal blasting. So, and another night, when we were in the day,